Well, the scoreboard said I lost today, but what the scoreboard doesn't say is what it is I have found.
Hello and welcome back to the Tennis Connected Studios for June 3rd, 2018. I'm Nima Nadeiri alongside John Horn, and we're here this week to preview week two at the French Open. This week's podcast is brought to you by Grand Slam Tennis Tours. Make sure to hit them up for the upcoming Wimbledon Championships as well as the US Open later this summer. First and foremost, before we begin, let's introduce our co-host for this week. John, how are you, my friend?
Doing well, man. Thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it.
And for everybody out there, John has been on our show previously. He's doing freelance commentary and he's a producer for ESPN. He does WTA matches for their network as well as TSN. So pleasure to have you here, and looking forward to the show. So let's get it going.
Yeah, looking forward to talking French Open. This should be good. Absolutely. Entertaining first week.
Yeah. And so basically the rundown of the show this week, we're going to get into some matches are quarters, some still round of 16. We're going to get into that, both women's and men's. We're going to talk a little bit about the vibe of Roland Garros this year, how we're feeling about, you know, the no roof, the cold weather, the stands aren't really that full. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the next gen, their court assignments, some words that Fabio Fognini had for them, and if that's really justified. So let's get right into it, John. So we have the draws out here. Let's start with the men. So we have some fourth round encounters that will take place tomorrow. We have, the undisputed king of clay. We got Rafa Nadal, number one seed. He looks like he's rolling. He hasn't really been troubled except for that first set that he had, or the last set that he had against Boelli in the first round. Martyr is his next opponent. I don't think that's going to be anything short of a three-set encounter there. I don't know what your thoughts are, but we'll get into that in a second. But other players that we have Diego Schwartzman, we've got Anderson, Cilic, Fognini, Isner, Del Potro. And then in the quarters, we have Djokovic, and then we have Thiem and Zverev that are highlighted there. So does anything here stick out to you? And is anything here like, you know, where you're like, oh, that shouldn't be that way, and, you know, this is actually the way that it should be? So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, really this is Rafael Nadal's tournament to lose. If you look at what's happened so far, he's obviously the guy to beat. He's won 35 straight sets at the French Open. He's won his first three matches in straight sets. I mean, what's shocking is the fact that Nadal is so good. It's not shocking that he's good, but the fact that he's doing it so easily.
Yes.
If you look at his last 35 sets dating back to last year and even his last appearance before that, when he wins the sets, he's winning them like 6-love, 6-1, 6-2 regularly. He's only been challenged really in that first round match in the third set where he had to go to a tiebreak. It's the only set that's been past 6-4 in his 35 sets that he's won in a row. So, he's obviously the clear favorite, I think, at this point, based on everything you've seen. I liked the way Martyr played against Shapovalov. I think he's got a good serve. He looks like he's confident out there, another backwards hat guy. But I agree with you. I think that really, you know, I think Nadal should probably dust them off in straight sets. I think the biggest advantage, too, for Nadal that he's going to have here, not that he needs any more advantages, is just the fact that the two players that I thought were really going to challenge him in this tournament have really had trouble in their first matches. Other than that first round match that Zverev won, the number two seed, he's struggled. I mean, he's gone five sets in his last three matches in a row, and
yes,
all three of those matches he's been down 2-1. Not to take anything away from the players that he's played, Zimmer is a good player, and Kachanov is a good player too. But the fact that he's really struggled and he's been on the court for 12 hours, I think that in the long run, if he's able to get through to the final, that's where Nadal is really going to be able to just capitalize. I know Zverev's a young kid and he's a good player. He's got lots of experience. He's won some thousand titles now, and this is the furthest he's gotten in a slam. But that really takes a toll on the clay when you've played that many matches and been on court for that long too. So and he's going to have to get past Dominic Thiem, who's a great player on clay as well. Zverev did meet Thiem in Madrid to win the title this year a couple weeks ago. And team, even if team beats Zverev, I mean, he hasn't exactly cruised through his matches either. I mean, you look at his matches, other than the first round match, he's needed four sets in two matches and five sets in another just to move on as well. So I think that this, again, all plays into Nadal's hands and really just makes it easier for him. I mean, there's other good competition, I think, when you look at who's left. The fact that Djokovic is in the quarters, I think, is good for him. I don't really see him beating Thiem or Zverev, but maybe he's played a little less than those two guys, so that maybe is an advantage. And then when you go back into the top half of the draw and you look at the fourth round matches that's still to be played, Cilic and Fanini, I mean, you never know where you're going to get from both of those guys at any point in time. Yes. You could get classic Fanini, or you could get 6-1, 6-1, 6-1 losing Fanini. So you never know. And Cilic too is the same thing too. You never know what you're going to get. Isner is not really a big clay court guy. Del Potro has been sort of injured. He looks like he's been healthy so far, but you never know when something's going to come up with him. So Diego Schwartzman will be a nice match if he can get past Kevin Anderson. He's won both his titles on clay, and he's a good clay court player. But you know, really, when you look at the men's side, I think it's really Nadal's tournament to lose, and that's not surprising, really, even before the tournament started. But just based on the fact that Thiem and Zverev have had these matches where that have gone longer than I think they would have liked, I think that's going to be a real detriment to them.
Yeah, and I think when, you know, for me, it's interesting because, you know, Thiem's coming in after winning the Lyon title, which was a very suspect call by him, even though he won the tournament last week. He's coming in now. He's a little bit jaded. He's, you know, he beat Nishikori today in four sets. He's got Zverev. You know they're going to go to town on each other, and who knows what's going to happen with that. That may be another four-hour match there. And then there's Novak Djokovic potentially, right, in the semis. And Djokovic coming in pretty fresh, right? So you have to think that why this wouldn't be a Djokovic-Nadal final next Sunday. And if that's the case, you know that Nadal respects this guy. And whenever they ask him, you know, are you happy that you didn't face Djokovic or this? And he goes, listen, I'm not stupid, man. Like, I'm not going to tell you that I want to face this guy. You know what I mean? Because he knows that the matchup is not a good one. Yes, this is not like prime time, you know, vintage Novak Djokovic when he was rolling everybody for 2 or 3 years every week. But nevertheless, you still have a situation where that history is there, and the matchup is a good one for Novak. And I think that if he can get there, I'm not sure. Like you said, definitely still Zverev and Thiem at this stage in the game are the favorites if that matchup takes place against either one of those guys. But if he can somehow plow through those two, then I think that it's going to be a pretty decent final. I mean, I can't see Nadal losing against anybody. I mean, Ben Rothenberg, who does some writing for us as of late, you know, he says that Isner is the only guy who can trouble Nadal in this section here, in this draw. And I really don't agree with him, to be honest with you, because what does Isner have really to bother? He's going to go to five tiebreakers, except for the last set. Like, that's not going to... He's going to wear down. And this is... How old is Isner now? I know they had that great match back in the day, right? It was like a five-set first round.
Yep.
But Isner's also older too, right? And he's not...
Isner's not a big clay court guy. I mean, he's a hard court guy. I mean, he'll get a lot of probably free points with a serve, no doubt about it. But Nadal's just going to wear him down. I mean, that's just this is what he does. The guy, the players who can compete with Nadal are the players who can go, you know, 4 or 5 hours with him, not so much maybe on clay, but, you know, they can go get into long rallies and actually have a chance of winning points. And that's the one thing that Nadal is so good at is that he, even though he's had injuries and so forth, he's still so fit and he gets to so many balls and he makes the other players hit great shots just to beat him. And after a while, he wears players down. And really, you know, when you look at all the players that are left at this point in the draw, obviously Zverev and Thiem are both fit players. Thiem, you were saying earlier, won Lyon last week. This guy plays so many matches, it's crazy. Yes. I think he likes to wear himself down. Plus, he did break, I think he had a broken foot or ankle or something earlier this year, so he did miss 3 or 4 weeks. So he's kind of making up for those matches that he missed. But
amazing.
When you look at the other players who are left, I mean, there's not really a lot of players. They're good players there, but there's nobody other than really those two guys to me that really stand out. Because you look at, you know, Anderson is a big player, but he's not a clay court guy. This is like probably the furthest he's gone in a clay court Grand Slam. Cilic is a good clay court player, but he's a big guy. He's you know, sometimes his fitness gets questioned a little bit. Fanini, he always struggles against Nadal. And Del Potro, you just don't know. I mean, yeah, obviously Del Potro's had two really good wins this year, but he always suffers with injuries. And I think for me, like, if Djokovic did get to the final and was able to get past Thiem or Zverev, you know, we saw a little bit of it in Rome a couple of weeks ago when Nadal beat Djokovic in the semis. They had a good first set. It was a tiebreak. It was pretty close. But then in the second set, you know, Djokovic kind of wore down and Nadal just did what he does. And I think that the fact that Djokovic hasn't had the matches behind him that he normally would, he's had some first round, second round, third round losses. He hasn't been on the court as much as he normally was or normally has been. I think that could be a detriment in this case. But yeah, you can't ignore 12 Grand Slams. I mean, he's kind of flying under the radar, to be honest with you. I mean, I think most people were, if he were to lose, in the first, second, or third round or fourth round this year, I don't think people really would have been that surprised just because he's been so up and down. He's had some reasonable results lately. But I just think that, you know, ultimately the downfall will be that Djokovic just hasn't been playing enough and it's Nadal's best surface. And maybe it'd be a different story if it was, say, the U.S. Open or Wimbledon. But in this case, because it's on clay, I think you have to just favor Nadal. It's hard not to.
Okay, so the dynamic for me here too, John, something that we have to mention is that the weather looks awful for the rest of this week, and we'll get into the roof stuff and everything in a bit later on in the show, but that's also a major factor because Nadal loves the spin. He loves when it's hot and the ball is flying off of the court, right? But when it's damp and cold, you don't get the same effect, right, from his shots. So when you have, like, that's how Soderling beat him back in the day, right, 2010. Yeah. It was very cold and rainy, and that's how he beat Federer the year after that as well, too. And, you know, you got a guy like Del Potro who doesn't really like to move, but if that's not really getting up on him, would that favor maybe if it was Nadal and Del Potro in the semis? I don't know. Maybe it's Cilic. Maybe
I think you're right. I mean, yeah. I think that the weather would play a little bit of a factor. Yes. The thing about Nadal is that he's just done. I mean, he's done it. You name it. You know, on clay, he's done it.
He's
it's not like he's won like three, four tournaments. This guy's winning like double digit tournaments in Monte Carlo. He's won it 11 times or something. He's won it in Madrid so many times, in Rome so many times, in French so many times. He just dominates, so it doesn't really matter. He's seen the different types of weather. He's seen it when it's been smoking hot outside. He's seen it when it's been damper. He's been in a rain delay like he was in the final of Rome this year. He pretty much can cover every different aspect of the game. He's such an expert on this surface. But there'll be some factors that I think will help him or will help the opponent as opposed to favoring everything to Nadal.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think that Nadal is just so good on the surface that really what it boils down to is that it's going to be very difficult for any of the players that you look at that are remaining to me. For Zverev and Thiem were the two players that I really thought, you know, would be the two players that would challenge him. And now, when you look at how much tennis they've already played, I'm a little skeptical. They might get to the final, but I just don't even see Nadal losing a set right now at this point. I really don't.
Yeah. And so at this stage, what are you taking as your final four as we get closer to the weekend for everybody out there?
Boy, final four.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, obviously Nadal in the top. Out of the rest of the top, you know what? For some reason, I just think Fanini maybe yeah. get there. I don't know. Like, it's just he's one of those guys where he either bails out early and it bails out badly,
yeah.
or he ends up getting deep and then he goes, you know, deeper than you actually would think he would. I mean, he had a 5-set win against Edmund, which was a good win for
Very
him.
Very impressive. Yeah.
And he is a guy who sort of flies under the radar a little bit just because he's. You know, his antics and everything that he does and what he says and the way he plays. And he almost sometimes goes out there like he doesn't really care. And he kind of flies under the radar. But, I mean, he is the 18th seed. And I think the Cilic match against him will be interesting. And then, you know, maybe he gets a break with Isner, who's not used to playing in quarterfinal clay court matches. And Del Potro maybe is a little, you know, wonky, which he often is. And you know, maybe he sneaks in there. So, if you were to ask me, I'd say Nadal and Fanini on the one side.
Mm.
And I think, you know, I like Djokovic's chances against the Italian Cecinato. I just think that that will be a match where experience comes into play. Tetsunato has played lots of tennis. I mean, he needed to win in four sets in his match before today, and then a four set match today. So, and I think it was a five setter that he won 10-8 in the first round as mm-hmm. well. So,
yes.
In the fifth set. So, I think Djokovic there. I'm going to give the advantage to team against Djokovic. I'm going to call it team Djokovic only because of the fact that Zverev's played a lot of tennis, yes. and I think he might be able to wear him down. So I'll go team and Djokovic on the one side, Nadal and Fanini on the other.
Okay, and then so for me, I'm going to go with Nadal, obviously. Against Del Potro, I think he's going to somehow sneak through just based on experience, even though clay is not his best surface. He is a former semifinalist at this event, I believe yep. the year that Federer won it, actually. And then I'm going to go with Djokovic to make the semis.
Yeah
I'm going to go with team just because, as you mentioned, I think Zverev's going to be a bit tired. I'm going to go with Djokovic over team. I'm going to go with Nadal over Del Potro. And then I'm going to have Nadal winning his 17th Grand Slam and, you know, standing only three away from Roger Federer. How about yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's very difficult to bet against Nadal. I mean, honestly, I don't think, quite honestly, it's not going to matter whether it's Zverev team, Djokovic, Cecinato. I don't think it's going to matter on that half or who finishes where in the remaining fourth round matches. I think it's Nadal's tournament, hands down. And I haven't looked at the betting odds, but he has to be an enormous favorite at this point. And I think probably even more so now based on who's left and based on the fact that Thiem and Zverev have played a lot of tennis and the fact that Djokovic hasn't been playing a lot too. So I think that everything right now sort of looks to be in Nadal's favor. And really, I just don't see how he can lose. Honestly, I don't.
Yeah. And the thing is, what people don't also sometimes they forget is that Nadal is such a momentum-based player, kind of like a Dominic Thiem. Obviously, he hasn't had nearly as much success. But if you go back to even 2013, when he won like Cincy in Canada and in the Canadian Open, then he won the U.S. Open. And he always goes on these streaks. He doesn't come, like, if he's in poor form, like when he lost to Djokovic at the French a couple of years ago and then Wawrinka ended up winning, he wasn't playing that well. And then he didn't end up winning that tournament at the French. So it's kind of like that. Like when he's in this form, he's just like a freight train and he's going to go through. Yeah. And it's something absolutely crazy has to happen here for him not to win this tournament. And I don't know what that is, but I can't see it happening.
Well, look at what's happened with Nadal this year. Like you said, talking about riding momentum and swings. I mean, he plays Monte Carlo. He wins all five matches. Doesn't drop a set, really doesn't get challenged in any set. Then he goes to Barcelona. He wins all five matches there, doesn't drop a set there. He goes to Madrid, wins his first two matches very easily, has a stumble against Thiem. Then he goes to Rome, and then he actually has a couple three-set matches there, one against Fanini where he played a really poor first set in that quarterfinal. And then, that weird rain-delayed set against Zverev, which he ended up losing 6-1, which is almost unheard of for him. But his other matches were bruised in those and won all five matches there. So really, 17-1 coming into the French Open. That's momentum, and he's been doing it. And it's not like he's playing, terrible players either.
No.
I mean, he has a win over Djokovic. He has a win over Fanini, a win over Chapeau. Lost a team, yes, but Tsitsipas has played well. He beat him. He beat Goffin. He beat Nishikori.
Zverev.
Monte Carlo. Dimitrov. So he's beaten good players along the way, too. It's not just these aren't just like bottom of the pile, play once in a while on clay players. These are like good players all the way along.
Exactly. Okay, so now as we move now to the women's draw, you're obviously going to have some great insight because you're calling a lot of these matches as of late. So we got fourth round matches that are going to be on tap tomorrow. Simona Halep still in search of that elusive first major. We got Kerber, who's not really a clay court player. Caro Garcia, who's obviously, the French hopeful on the women's side. We got Muguruza, former winner here. We got Serena Williams versus, Sharapova, which is an absolute blockbuster tomorrow. And then we have some players that have already moved into the quarterfinals, which is highlighted by Madison Keys and Sloane Stephens, the reigning U.S. Open winner and the reigning U.S. Open runner-up. So from what you've seen in this, women's draw here, what has, stood out to you, with all the matches that you've... We should just start with the cream of the crop here with the Serena and Sharapova match tomorrow, which is going to be awesome. It's one of those things where I kind of talk to you, you know, about the Djokovic Nadal, even though Djokovic not playing that well and Nadal is on fire, you know, when that there's that one match and you just got to play that one match. Doesn't matter what's happened before, doesn't matter what's going to happen after. And it's kind of same thing here with Serena. She's dominated Sharapova throughout their career. Sharapova has played a ton of more tennis in the last year and a half. And arguably just as good as a clay court player, I would say, as Serena, if you look at from, you know, a career standpoint. And then you have what's going to happen, though, tomorrow. I mean, Serena's in her head. There's no question about it. Sharapova has more tennis under her belt as of late. Can we go with Sharapova to win this match? Does she have a chance? Or is Serena just going to, you know, just be Serena and roll through this one?
Well, I think that when you look at the matchup, based on what you just said as well, I think that, this is probably Sharapova's best shot at beating Williams in a long, long time. I mean, just think about the fact that Serena and Sharapova have played 21 times, and Serena has won 19 straight matches, and 15 of the last 17 have been in straight sets. So she's just been cruising along. But this is different. I mean, this is a different Serena Williams, who's 451 in the world, who's coming up having a baby, you know, has other responsibilities besides tennis. I mean, but the one thing I'll say about women's tennis, and this is sort of got into a couple of discussions about this, is that, you know, it's a totally different ballgame when, you know, anybody who's, you know, got a wife or girlfriend or who's had a child knows that it's just different. You have other responsibilities and you're, you know, you don't just come home and then sit down and watch TV and do whatever you want or go for dinner or do anything like that. And in fact, we're in that this is a professional tennis player who's trying to be at the top of her game and practice and eat right and do all these things. And then you've got an 8-month-old baby you've got to look after. And, you know, I mean, just think of everything that you have to do when you have a baby. And then on top of that, oh, by the way, we need you to, you know, play competitive tennis in a Grand Slam against the best players in the world. This is a real challenge, and I think that you know, Serena's already admitted that it's been a bit of a difficulty trying to balance the two. She came back and played a little bit at Indian Wells and lost in the first round in Miami, and that was on her home soil. Now she's, you know, in France. I know she has her daughter with her and got a good support system, obviously. But it's different when, you know, you go on the court and then you practice for a couple hours and then you sweat, you're training, and you know, and then you come home and it's, you can't just sit on the couch. You want to be a mom. I'm not saying you have to be a mom, but you want to be a mom. You want to see your daughter. You want to play with her. You want to do stuff with her. And it's not all just tennis. And maybe that's a good thing. I don't know. But it's definitely a different mindset than what she used to have before. And, there are other mothers on tour who've gone through it as well and are going through it. And it's difficult. And so now you're being asked to play against Maria Sharapova, who's, like you said, has played a lot more than her of late. And it's still, you know, she may not be a top 10 player, a top 20 player. She's still a top 35 player, and she's still a good player. And I think that for Serena, you know, she's played well, I think, you know, considering what she's, you know, the fact that she's come back. She played no clay court matches coming into this tournament. I thought she played a decent match against Julia Gergis and ended up winning in straight sets. And I think Sharapova has the edge. But just Serena's match play and just her experience, there's just something about being on the other side of the court when Serena is on the other side of the court. It's like when Federer comes back and plays, you're like, how can this guy come back from knee surgery and then suddenly start knocking off these players? Yeah. I think there's a lot of it is that the other player, the player is good, like Serena and Federer is, but a lot of it is what's going on the other side of the court. It's the intimidation factor. It's the fact that, you know, you walk on the court against Serena, you walk on the court against Federer, you know, you're almost intimidated thinking you're not going to win from the start. I know that's not the right attitude, but it's almost impossible not to be that way because they're the greatest in their sport. So, you know, if I were to put, you know, a couple dollars on it, I mean, I would say that Serena wins, but there's certainly, I think this is the year that Sharapova would have the best shot based on everything that's happened right now.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, when you look at the dynamics, I like the way Serena's playing. I think she's playing very smooth, nice rhythmic motion. I mean, her serve is amazing, and I think she's got it's right where it needs to be, and she's not really hitting a ton of unforced errors like we saw earlier in the year. She's been training a lot at the Mouratoglou Academy right there in France, so she's very acclimated to the conditions, and I think she's ready to go. And I think, but with that said, I think Sharapova's playing well too, and you know that. You know, at the end of the day, this is still a five-time Grand Slam champion. She knows what she needs to do out there, too. She's won this tournament on two previous occasions. This is a 50-50 for me. I want to give, even maybe I'm going to go 51-49 for Sharapova, for the sake that at the U.S. Open, if this match took place again, or Wimbledon even, I'm going Serena Williams 100%. But sure. I think just because it's here and now, I'm going to go 51-49 Sharapova. But with that, go ahead.
I think that's probably you're probably right. This is probably the tightest when those two have been on paper in the last bunch of tournaments that they've played. This is the closest match where you look at it, you go Serena Sharapova.
Yes.
You go, wow, like who could actually win this match? Before, you just look at it quickly and you go, oh yeah, Serena will win that. Mm-hmm. And then, she'll win that one too. Yeah, she'll win that. The better surface. Sharapova's not playing well. Serena's in her head. You just look at it, you look at all those things, and you would just automatically say Serena's going to win that match. But based on everything else that's gone on, the fact that Serena hasn't played a lot of clay, she's a mother now, and that she's, I don't know. There's lots of different factors where I think that Sharapova certainly has a chance, a better chance than she's had. But look, Sharapova beat Karolina Pliskova. She was actually my dark horse to actually win. I shouldn't call her a dark horse, but she was one of the picks that I thought would actually go all the way because she's just been playing so well. She was the player of the month on the WTA in April.
Yeah.
And
she got smoked. She
plays really good tennis, and she's got that big serve, and Sharapova dusted her 2-1.
Yeah.
So that's another factor to look into as well, is that Sharapova is beating good players along the way.
For sure. And, obviously, when we're looking at Serena, with, the whole, her outfit with the cat suit and all this stuff, that a lot of buzz that she's been gaining, I think that's also adding to this whole aura, you know what I mean? And, Sharapova and Serena have always had this rivalry on many different levels, you know what I mean? Like, it's not only on court, but it's off court, and there's so much drama that's surrounded these two throughout the years. So I think that this is going to be a good one. I think it's for sure the match of the day, both men's and women's tomorrow. So I think everybody's going to be pumped for that. But when you look at some other players here that, we got to talk about, Wozniacki and Kazakina, they're tied at, actually it's one set to love for Kazakina, 3-3 in second. Winner of that place, Sloane Stephens, who's made the fourth round here on a lot of previous occasions, but now she's in the quarters. Can she make the finals here? I mean, this doesn't look like a terribly bad draw for Sloane Stephens. If you look at it, Wozniacki's not going to blow her off the court. I watched, Kazakina today. Amazing forehand. Really hits that hard and flat. Serve is not good at all, in my opinion. But I would look at Sloane as the favorite in that match. And then you got Madison Keys. If she gets through her match, and that's a rematch, rematch of the U.S. Open Finals. Who knows what's going to happen there? And then you're into the finals. And then when we look at the top half, Halep hasn't proven herself, even though she's number one in the world. Garcia's got a ton of pressure here. Kerber's not really a clay quarter. Muguruza, maybe, again, she's won this tournament in previous years. And I don't know. I mean, if you're going to pick four players right now as your semifinalists here and some other storylines that maybe we should follow, what would they be?
Well, I agree that I think that Sloane Stephens has been playing some good tennis at this tournament. I did a couple of her matches in Madrid that she played, and she had a very dominant first-round match, which I called. And then she had I don't know if this is a word, a non-dominant third-round match where she got pretty much blown off the court by Pliskova. So I've seen both sides of Sloane Stephens. She likes to go for a lot. She's got that big forehand. Her serve's pretty consistent as well. And really, when you look at what she's done so far in the tournament, she's had a couple of 6-2, 6-love wins, and she got through in the third round, winning 8-6 in the third. But I like the way that she's playing, and she's got the confidence of the fact that she's won a Grand Slam now. She knows what it takes to get to a Grand Slam final, and I think that definitely makes a difference when there's all that pressure on you. And Madison Keys has got a little bit of that, too. She never got to a Grand Slam final. She's been close. We obviously saw what she did at the U.S. Open. She's coming off some surgeries from last year. You always look at the players and you go, okay, who's won a slam, and how can that experience going into a Grand Slam or trying to make their way through a Grand Slam, how can that make a difference? So, I like the fact that Stephens has been playing well. And to me, I just don't see Wozniacki. I think Kazakina, I think, again, she's had a good year for the most part. I think that she could probably win that match against Wozniacki, but
yes.
I would like Stevens to win against either of those two players, no matter what happens.
Yep.
And then we could see maybe a Keys-Stevens semifinal, which would be pretty cool. Again, like it's been such a lull for U.S. tennis players, and now you're starting to see a little bit of, you know, we saw it at the U.S. Open last year on the women's side. So many, you know, women's players from the U.S. starting to, you know, find their groove a little bit with Vandeweghe, obviously Stevens, Keys, Venus getting in that mix as well, and Serena coming back, and, you know, even on the men's side with Isner winning Miami too. So you could have an All-American semifinal in the, on the bottom half of the draw. In the top half, we're obviously still talking fourth round here, but you know, there's some players that they can play you know, good tennis at any point in time. I think, you know, you'd have to. I'm kind of rooting for Simona Halep, and I know she's the number one seed, and it always just seems that she gets so close and just doesn't get there. I'd really like to see her get her first slam, and this is a good surface that she plays well on, and she's had a pretty relatively easy first few matches, so. She did drop that first set in the first round, however, but I think that, you know, against Mertens, who's a good player. I think Mertens won a tournament earlier this year. You said Kerber's not really a clay courter. And you never know what you're going to get from Muguruza, to be honest. And so, you know, if you were to give me the final four, I'll go with Keys and Stevens in the bottom half, and I'll go with Halep, and we'll go Halep Muguruza on the top half. And then if I were to take the winners, give me Sloane Stephens against Halep, and I'll take Halep over Stephens to win it.
Oh, wow. Okay. So for me, I'm going to go actually with Caro Garcia as my semifinalist. I think she's going to ride that French wave. Again, I'm with you. I mean, I would love to see Simona win a tournament like this. It's just there's something there. There's some demons in her head, and she just doesn't have that big of a game as an overall, and that continues to bite her, you know what I mean? And I think, for me, it's going to be, I think Caro Garcia goes to the semis. I think Sharapova will meet her there. I think Sharapova will get through Serena tomorrow, as well as Muguruza. So I think she's playing well enough to do that. Then it's going to be interesting because the home crowd and everything on Garcia's side. But I think it's going to be Sharapova in the finals for me. And then on the bottom, I'm going Sloane Stephens all the way against Madison Keys. I think she's going to defeat Keys. I think it's going to be Sloane and Sharapova. Then it's going to be interesting for me because I think Sloane can raise her level. She's proven that throughout her career. She doesn't really play that well in smaller tournaments, but she does in the majors. I just tough. I think if it was going to be Sloane and Sharapova in the finals, I think at this stage, if the match was going to take place tomorrow, I'm going to go with Sharapova in three sets. Just based on grit and determination. I think, and it's going to be a great comeback story. But again, it's a little bit of a hope. But, I mean, anything is really possible, especially on clay, especially on the women's side. There's so many players that can win these tournaments, unlike the men's side. And that's something that Wozniacki alluded to. She said, this tournament gives me hope because we don't have a Nadal on our tour. Somebody just comes in and rolls this tournament for over a decade. You know what I mean? So everybody has got pretty much a fair shot. So I think that's how we look at it. And I think that's pretty much it for the draw side. A couple other points that we wanted to allude to. You talked a little bit about, and we were speaking about, like, you know, players that are top players and getting regulated to different, you know, different courts. And we had Simona Halep playing on court 18. And, you know, Fognini was talking about that. Like, he thinks the next gen on the men's side is BS. And you have, like, Shapovalov and, you know, Khachanov and all these younger guys playing on court 1 and Chatre and all of this stuff. And he was like, you know how Fognini is. He completely speaks his mind. He doesn't care. He's been fined. Oh, I mean, we know what happened with him at the U.S. Open. I believe it was last year. And that was crazy. But is there some truth to that? I mean, should the tournaments base who they're going to, you know, what court they're going to put players on merit? Or is it really based on who's hot? You know what I mean? Like, you know, we're Canadian and Bouchard's done nothing, but if she's in the main draw, she's going to get a good court. They're not going to put her on court 34. You know what I mean? They're going to put her on, you know, court 1-2 on at a big event. That's just the way it goes. And, you know, does Halep have that fanfare, even though she's number one in the world? We had, you know, a situation where Cilic is 3 in the world, but do a lot of people know really who he is? Maybe a little bit more now because he made the Australian Open final, Wimbledon final. But how does that all work? And do you think it's justified when you know players like Fognini make claims like that?
Well, I mean, I understand what Fognini's saying. I get his point and maybe his frustration.
Yes.
He, as you said, he often speaks his mind and isn't always accurate with everything that he says. I mean, look, the bottom line is with tennis, as it is with every other sport, is that certain players move the needle and sell tickets, and certain players don't. And quite honestly, with all due respect, Fognini is a character player that people watch. But at the same time, I don't know if he's like the draw that some of the other players are. I mean, the reason why you're seeing, Shapovalov, and maybe we're biased being in Canada, but the reason you're seeing him there is because of the fact that this guy sells tickets and that people will come to see Shapovalov play all over the world. It's not even just in Canada. Like, he's got a huge following in Asia, a huge following in Mexico. When I was at the Next Gen in Milan last year, huge following in Milan, and this was when he was just starting to take off last year. If you're going to be able to sell tickets on your main stadium court and get extra money for those tickets that you wouldn't, I mean, well, what's the benefit of putting Shapovalov on court 18 or court 7 where there's going to be less people can watch the match and you're not going to make any extra money off of it? People can just go in with a grounds pass and then just watch them. That doesn't make any sense. So,
no.
You understand from the player's frustration and, who needs to go where and that kind of thing. I've always thought, maybe it might be an idea to spread the players around a little bit so you have an opportunity.
Yes.
I also think sometimes it's obviously an advantage for certain players to play on the same court all the time. I mean, this is an example at Wimbledon. Federer always plays on center court, so if it rains, he always plays on that same court. He never gets a delayed match. He never, has to play two matches in a row like some of the other players do, and it becomes an advantage for the seeded players. But at the same time, they kind of earn that advantage.
Yes.
And I just think that ultimately it boils down to, the tournament's got to make money. They're paying $2.5 million to the winners, and they're paying, $50,000, $60,000 to the first round losers. So they somehow have to make some money. They get tons of money from sponsors and TV rights and that sort of thing. But if you're going to put Shapovalov on one of the main courts like Legland or Chatrier, there's a reason you're doing that, because you're trying to earn some extra money. And I really don't have a problem with that. Like, if you want to go and see the best player, the stars play, then you've got to fork out the dough. Why should you have to just pay a $15 ground pass to go and watch some of the best players? So I get what he's saying, and I know, just like any other tournament, just like Wimbledon, the Brits often get on the main court, and just in Canada, Rogers Cup, the Canadians get on. It's the same with the French Open. You see Lucas Pouille and Benoit Paire and Carol Garcia and all the French players, Malfis, they're all playing on the top courts because they're French, and they know that that's going to draw interest and they're going to make money off of those ticket sales. So I get why the players are frustrated, but at the same time, I also understand that it's a business and you have to put the right players in the right spot. So I just don't think really that, Fognini can say that, but you have to look at the overall picture. There's more to it than just the number beside the player's name. You have to look at it with the, who's going to draw attention? Are people going to want to see Zverev and Shapovalov and the top young players play? Or are you going to want to see Marin Cilic? Probably not. Like, nothing against Cilic, but his game's not quite as exciting as watching Shapovalov. Just like Zverev's game is more exciting to watch than an Isner match, which is just going to be aces and tiebreakers, right?
Yeah.
So I think you got to look at it from that standpoint.
Or a guy like Nick Kyrgios, who hasn't played basically this whole year. When he comes back, he's going to get good court time.
Just one quick last example is that Indian Wells, when Bouchard was playing there, a lot of people were disgusted by the fact that Bouchard was playing on center court, the main stadium court, 3 years in a row, every single match. Well, she wasn't, that was during the downfall years, and wasn't even seated a couple of times. And you heard a lot of scuttlebutt. It's ridiculous. Why is she on main stadium? Well, the reason she's on main stadium is because it's going to sell tickets. There's a lot of Canadians who come down to California just to watch the tournament.
Yes.
And let's get some more money out of them so that they don't just have a grounds pass and can watch her on court 12. Like, you actually have to pay to watch her play, and that's what the tournaments are thinking. It's all about what attention they can get, how much money they can make based on who plays on the court. So. It's the same sort of thing as the French, I think.
For sure. And I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a business. So when you have a business, you're trying to run your business as properly as possible. You're trying to make money as much as you can. And these guys have a 2-week event, 15-day event, and they got to maximize. And that's the bottom line. I mean, so they can pretty much do whatever they want, and it's going to continue to be that way.
It's impossible to make, you know, 128 men's players and 128 women's players 100% satisfied, right? Exactly. Like you can't do it. I would never want the job of being the scheduler of who goes on what courts and trying to get that all sorted out, especially when you factor in rain delays and, you know, players having injuries and, you know, trying to be fair to the players, fair to the fans. And it must be just a nightmare trying to put that schedule together. So for the most part, I think they do a pretty good job. Once in a while, there'll be a little crack in the armor. But like you said, and we've talked about it, it's a business. And you got to, you know, there's certain players who you know are going to be on the main courts just because based on where they're from or who they are.
Yes.
And you just have to live with that.
Absolutely. All right, John. So as we wrap up this week, we're just going to get into, you know, just some of the dynamics and the vibe of Roland Garros with, you know, it's the only major that doesn't have any roofs on any of their courts. And another thing that I've noticed more so this year than in previous years, I don't know why, but the stands are really not that full. And, you know, some people tweeted back at me, oh, it's because grounds passes are cheap, but, you know, the courts on Chatrier and Longlin are very expensive. And then there's all the corporate seats, but then they actually don't show up. And the optics of it are just terrible for, you know what I mean, for people who are watching on TV. They're like, what's going on? You know, I was out there today on the courts and people were like, how come nobody's at the tournament, man? What's going on? Is it Grand Slam? You know what I mean? And it's like, what am I supposed to say, right? I'm like, I don't know. Like, this is just... So, you know, do you have any insight on that? And the thing for me, the biggest irony is that, you know, for those of us that have been to France, man, they have a massive following for tennis. I mean, they're just like 300,000 kids playing tennis. It's just crazy. You know, if you want to become a coach.
Just watch Fed Cup or Davis Cup.
Yeah. And if you want to become a coach, like we have the OTA in Tennis Canada here, you got to go to school for 4 years to become a tennis coach there. It's like serious. And then it's just like, you know, when you go to Montreal, there's that vibe is there. It's very strong for both men's and women's. And then, but then there's nobody watching the tournament. Like what's happening?
Yeah. I think it's a combination of a number of things. I mean, ultimately, yes, the best seats in the house are usually corporate seats.
Yes.
So like the companies are the ones who can afford it. It's just like when you take a flight and you go, you know, wherever you're going and you walk through business class and there's a lot of empty seats. It's because the only people who are really spending the money to buy the business class or first class seats are corporations. Like, you know, the average person isn't forking out the $5,000, $7,000, $8,000 return to apply business class. So that's why it's so empty. And it's the same sort of thing with these corporate seats. I mean, they're all sold. It's a little different than flying business class or first class on a plane. But the fact is that, you know, a lot of corporate companies, they buy the seats just because it looks good on them with the people who are running the tournament.
Yes.
And, you know, you look at some of the events in Asia, for example, you know, you go throughout the week and there won't be anybody sitting in the lower part of the stadium until the final day. It's like people are just show up on the final for the final. It's sad, but it's comical at the same time. And, you know, I think that is a huge part of it. The one other thing that I think too, though, and, you know, we can all be guilty of this, is that, you know, when you have a team, whatever sport it is, or an event in your own backyard every single year, you know, let's just say in Canada, you know, every summer you're going to have, you know, the Canadian Open Golf Tournament, you're going to have the IndyCar race, and, you know, there's certain, you know, you've got the Raptors here and the Jays here all the time. You know, you get a little bit complacent.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, when you're, and as much as, you know, you maybe not comparing those sports to tennis grand slams, but, you know, when you're in a country that has a tennis tournament every single year, and it is a grand slam, and they also have an indoor tournament later in the year, you know, you get a little bit complacent. I even saw a little bit of that this year at the ATP Tour Finals at the O2 in London, is that, you know, they're so used to having so much tennis there. I mean, not only do they have Wimbledon, but they also have the Queen's Club event. And then there's Eastbourne, and then there's Birmingham, which isn't far away. Then they have the ATP Tour Finals. You know, when Federer was not in the finals, Nadal pulls out, you know, suddenly there's a lot of empty seats in that stadium, or in that arena, rather. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, people in those places, they'll get a lot of traveling fans who come for the first experience, or, you know, if you're in France, maybe you come from England or Switzerland to cheer on your favorite player. But for the most part, the people who are attending the events are from the city that the tournament is in, And I think that it just gets to be a little bit complacent. Like, hey, if you've been to the French Open four times and you've seen Nadal in five finals or four finals, then why do you think you need to go to watch a third round match? I don't know. That I think is a big part of it as well.
Yeah, it's a good point.
That sort of stops player or stops people, I think, from going every single year because they've already had the experience. And it sounds sad and it sounds kind of ridiculous because who wouldn't want to go to the French Open? The average person in Canada would give their right arm to go to a Grand Slam of any sort. But when it's in your own backyard every single year, you know, I think maybe that sort of gets people to be a little bit complacent and the people don't want to go as much. And I haven't seen the numbers on the ticket sales to say, you know, they're down from last year or, you know, they're better than last year. I have no idea. But I think that that would be the reason why, to me, that you start seeing less people at some of these events. And I saw it at the O2 this year. The crowds were definitely down for a lot of the Round Robin matches just because Nadal was out. But when Federer didn't play, you know, people weren't, you know, lining up to see Dimitrov and Sock play as much as those are great players. It's just people get complacent, don't want to fork out the money. And plus, it does cost a lot of money to go to the events, too. So not everybody's got that extra cash. And they know you can watch it on TV too, which makes a big difference.
Of course. Okay. All right, John. So that's going to be it for this week's show. We'll be back soon to wrap up the French Open next week. So, John, can you tell everybody out there where they can catch you next on, you know, for the WTA matches coming up for the grass court season?
Yeah, heading over to Europe. I'll be over there in a couple weeks.
Okay.
We got the WTA event in Birmingham, which has got a good field. I'll be doing some matches in Mallorca and Spain. That's home of the Rafael Nadal's tournament, which Tony Nadal is the tournament director there, actually. It's kind of funny.
Nice.
All these years of Tony Nadal with Rafael Nadal, and now he's the tournament director of that event. So that's kind of cool. And then great field at Eastbourne the week before the Wimbledon starts. So the WTA event in Eastbourne always gets a good draw. I'm not sure what the numbers are this year, but I know last year 17 of the top 20 players in the world were at Eastbourne playing the week before. So great tune-up event, a great location for tennis. So I'll be doing that, and then Wimbledon starts right after that. So it's going to be an exciting grass court season, and it all happens very quickly. We're almost halfway through the year, and I feel like we just started not that long ago at the Australian Open. So
for sure. And for everybody out there, make sure to follow John on Twitter at SportsHorn. You can follow everything that we're doing at Tennis Connected as well too. You can follow this podcast on Tennis Connected as well as subscribe to it on iTunes. Also, for everybody out there, make sure to hit up Grand Slam Tennis Tours for all your ticket and traveling needs. Once again, thank you to John, and thank you for everybody else for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode. Bye.